You're listening to Vatican Radio. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. I'd like to look ahead to Tuesday 24th of May, feast day of Our Lady Help of Christians, and World Day of Prayer for the Church in China. So to mark this special day, I thought I'd bring you a programme focusing on the figure of Matteo Ricci, one of the founders of the Jesuit mission in China, a man who died in 1610 and whose legacy still lives on in China today. But why don't you listen to Jesuit Father Emmanuel Lim in a programme focusing on the figure of this charismatic Jesuit. Stay tuned then as I put you in the picture. The closest to China I've ever been is Macau. Like most people, I reached this port at the mouth of the Pearl River, once known as Oyster Mirror, by boat, crossing the South China Sea. I couldn't help myself from thinking that I was following in the steps of Italian Jesuit, Matteo Ricci, who travelled to this city only four centuries earlier, when it had only just been made an episcopal see by Pope Gregory XIII in 1582. It was easy for me to imagine him arriving there in the humid subtropical climate to attend what was then the first Western college in the Far East, in an effort to learn the language which would allow him access to China. It was a time of religious ferment for Catholics in Macau, and plans for a great cathedral were being drawn up. The landmark skeleton facade of this cathedral still stands proud today with its grandiose staircase. And indeed, it's a place where Matteo Ricci's name still lingers on to this day. But for Ricci, Macau was only a stepping stone. He was not there to stay and see the cathedral built. His mission was to the Ming court in Peking. And to make things easier, he took a Chinese name, Li Matu.
Li Matu, yes. I think he got his Chinese name when he arrived in Macau. Because during those years, the Chinese government is always quite suspicious of foreigners. They don't allow foreigners to go in, except just for trade, you know.
I asked Jesuit Father Emmanuel Lim to tell me more about Ricci's entry into China. He'd obviously entered cautiously, taking precautions to diffuse suspicions. And not being able to pass as a trader, he thought he'd fare better as a man of the cloth, I'd heard. Was it really true that he'd adopted the garb of a man of the cloth? One which had to be friendly and familiar locally, such as that of the Buddhist monk. And did he and his companion, another Italian Jesuit by the name of Michele Ruggeri, really shave their heads and don the garb of unknown monks?
Yes, it's true. He thought that the Buddhist monks were respected, were treated like the priest in the Western countries in Europe. So that's why he dressed himself as a Buddhist monk.
However, Father Lim told me, Ricci may have been correct in adopting the robes that mark the presence of a man of God, but he adopted the wrong ones. So, which were the right ones? Well, it seems those of the Confucian scholar, ceremonial square bonnets and silk robes. Those drew far more respect at the court.
In China, during those times, Buddhist monks did not have high respect from people, the scholars. The scholars, they are the one who has, people who respect them and want to listen to them. So later he changed into dressed like a scholar, Confucian scholar.
But Ricci, who was nicknamed the wise man from the West, had more up his sleeve in his effort to bring Christian religion to the attention of the court of the Chinese emperors. For example, gifts, tangible signs of friendship, from paintings and breviaries to precious stones and sand clocks. I asked Father Lim about this clever ploy to introduce concepts of religion that must have been totally foreign to the emperor in a visual manner.
during those years, the Chinese, they do not know much about the Western world and the culture. And you have to show them something that's tangible that they can see, and they find this is something really different that we have not seen in China. So that interests them, especially brought in the prism. You know,
the prism,
yes. Mm. The light, when you go through and see the seven colors, like rainbows, and also the clock.
So a mixture of religious objects and
ordinary
sort like, of...
Yeah, so-called technology, those days.
IT.
Yeah, IT, yes.
IT from those years.
Yes,
yes. As Father Lim had brought to my notice how foreign Western culture was to the Chinese in those days, I wondered how foreign Christianity was to them at the beginning of the 17th century. I discovered, to my surprise, that in earlier times, Christians had not been so foreign to the people of this nation. It was at the time of the Mongols.
Before Ming Dynasty began, there was Christianity in China. That was during the Mongolians, they ruled China. And after that, there was a revolution and they overthrown the Mongolian dynasty. Because during those years, the Mongolians welcomed missionaries from the West. So the Han people thought that Christians, the Catholics, are friends of the Mongolians. So when they overthrown the Mongolians, they threw out everything. They threw out the Catholics too, so, and the Christians. So during those years, during the Ming Dynasty, a Christian is a very small minority, I mean a few hundreds perhaps in China, especially in Beijing and those years.
But anyway, recapitulating, in answer to my earlier question, by the time Ricci arrived in China, Christianity was largely unknown, something new, something foreign, and therefore suspect.
They're always suspicious of the foreigners. They are coming in to try to conquer China, or you know, they have this kind of mentality. They are afraid of foreigners, actually.
A diffidence.
They're different, yes. Yeah.
But Ricci had no end of trump cards. As Father Lim mentioned earlier, the Chinese had great respect for scholars. And Ricci, let's not forget this, ranked as one of the most cultivated men of his time, a sort of Renaissance figure, with expertise in a broad range of fields, from maths to astronomy to linguistic expertise. I asked how this played into his hands.
When he was in Macau, he learned a lot about the Chinese classics. During those years, he really learned about China. That's why he can dress himself as a Mandarin. And when people talk to him, he knows what he's talking about. He knows what to talk to the people about. And
plus, the intellectuals.
Yeah, the intellectuals also. And also with his Western knowledge. With all this new knowledge he brought in, that fascinated the people there, especially the well-educated people, those Mandarins in China. So that attracts people to him. That's why there are so many well-educated people during those times that approached him. And later, they were converted and they become Catholics, you know, especially like the Prime Minister during the Ming Dynasty, Xu Guangqi, Paul Xu. He was a minister that time in the court, and his friends also were converted to Christianity.
Certainly these conversions were made easier by Ricci's expert linguistic skills and his hard work at translation of Christian truths into Chinese, such as the Ten Commandments. But I asked Father Lim, can one safely affirm he laid the groundwork for the Chinese to accept Christianity into their culture?
Yes, yes. In fact, during those years, the Jesuits translated even the Mass and into Chinese, breviary into Chinese, everything.
It seems Ricci laid the groundwork all right, to the extent that over 80 years after his death, the Kangxi Emperor issued an edict granting toleration to the Christian religion. But then two serious stumbling blocks surfaced on the horizon, focusing around the Chinese rite of ancestor worship and public homage to Confucius, pitting on the one hand the Jesuits in Peking and on the other Dominicans and Franciscans who lived in different parts of China.
They were in different parts of China, and the Jesuits were in Beijing, where you find many well-educated Chinese Mandarins there. And what they understood about paying respect to the ancestor, that's just a cultural thing. But for the other missionaries who were in the southern part of China, and they were dealing with people who are not well-educated, the rural area, and those people, they saw this kind of ceremony. It's like worshipping the ancestor so that the ancestor will protect them.
A controversy which ended up in Rome, where the Pope sided with the Franciscans and the Dominicans, placing a ban on the Chinese ceremonial rite of respect of ancestors, enforced by his nuncio.
During the Qing Dynasty, nuncio, who came from Rome, he was responsible to tell the people, all the Catholics, that you are not supposed to pay respect to ancestors. You are not supposed to take part in the rite. And the emperor, the Kangxi emperor, the emperor heard about this, and he met with the nuncio, and he pointed at the Chinese word on top of the cot there, and said, "Can you read these words?" And the nuncio said, "No, I can't read Chinese." And said, "Now, you do not know anything about the Chinese culture. Don't come and tell us what we should do and what we should not do." It's a sad story, but we should learn from this mistake.
It was a ban only revoked as late as the 1930s. A sad story, but unfortunately the damage was done, and the ensuing result was a far cry from Ricci's illuminated thinking and understanding of Chinese culture. Let's read from his diary in this respect.
The work of evangelization, of making Christians, should be carried on both in Peking and in the provinces, following the methods of Pacific penetrations and cultural adaptations. Europeanism is to be shunned.
The most important thing is Matteo Ricci came in to China with the kind of respect to the Chinese culture. He came as a friend. He really learned about the Chinese culture and try to speak to the Chinese way. And it's not like some, you know, missionaries, they like to use their own language and the sign, symbol of the Western culture. So I think that is very important why he was successful. Even today, he is so much respected. He came to China and he learned all about the Chinese culture.
You're a Jesuit yourself. In terms of Jesuit spirituality, would you say Ricci embodies the goals of the Society of Jesus? And if so, which of these in particular, in your opinion?
The way he tries to bring gospel to the Chinese people is very, very Jesuit way of doing it, because St. Ignatius said that when you start a conversation with someone, you have to go through their door and come out through our door. That means you have to start with what they are interested in. Start with those things that they are interested in. And you talk about that, then lead them to Christ. You see, Matteo Ricci, he was trying to talk to people using their language rather than using his own language. Then lead them to Christ. And this is very Jesuit.
Looking outwards, can one affirm that Ricci introduced Chinese culture to the Western world?
Yes.
Stimulating, for example, Chinese studies in Europe?
Yes. Yes. He was the one to translate so many of the Chinese classics into the Western language. Yeah. He's been seen as a great figure, not only among the Catholics, also among the Chinese population, because even now in China, in some places, in like in a city, Nanchang, they built a big statue of Matteo Ricci in the park. So that's a great respect to him, because he was the one to bring the Western culture to China, and also from China to the West. You see, he was a bridge between these two, the two worlds.
A bridge between East and West. Four centuries on, the memory of Matteo Ricci, to the Chinese Li Mateu, still lives on in China today. Li Mateu, the Jesuit missionary, who, when he passed away, was survived by 2,500 Chinese Catholics. Among these, many from the educated classes, as well as 18 fellow Jesuits, half of whom were indigenous Chinese. That was Jesuit Father Emmanuel Lim speaking to us of Matteo Ricci. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick.